Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It's Monday, March 9th, and we have Representative Greenlich, so I'm just going to temporarily open a work session, a public hearing on Senate Bill 663, and he is going to give the introductory remarks to our modernization of public health bill, and then he's going to take off and go to judiciary, and then I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate bill. Well, since everyone's here, I think we'll just run through the work sessions real quick, and then we'll jump to 121. Okay. I open a public hearing on Senate Bill 663.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm delighted to be here on Senate Bill 663, which has a parallel bill in the House, House Bill 3100. Your chair and I have been working on together. This, you'll hear some really great testimony later, particularly from Commissioner Bainey, who chaired the commission that developed the report from which this bill derives. We, in the 13th session, passed House Bill 2348, which brought the commission together, talking about how we can modernize the public health system. We have a bill that is a work in progress, so you'll hear testimony today, and you'll hear a lot of suggestions for how to improve it. We had a very nice hearing a couple of hours ago in the House Healthcare Committee, but I just want to make a couple of points about this. This bill will create a process by which the Oregon Health Authority, working with 36 counties, produces over the next 2 years a 10-year plan for the modernization of public health. It is very clear that in order to produce that, OHA will have to work with each of the counties individually, with the counties working with OHA saying, here's where we plan to be going in the next 10 years if we have this amount of resource to allow it to go forward. We are a very underfunded state, and it's clear, and I made clear to both chairs of Ways and Means, that over the next decade we're going to need a significant larger amount of money into the public health system in order to deal with the future of public health. You'll hear about all sorts of public health problems that are going on in this state right now that we really don't have the resources to meet. But it isn't clear in this version of the bill, and we need to make it clear that that process by which we create a master plan for 36 counties needs to have the approval of every single county in order to go forward, because we can't be saying, here's what Curry County has to do, and Curry County says, huh? That just won't work. So it is very clear that when we get into the next version of it that we will be assuring that both the resources that are needed to modernize the public health system, and you'll hear about what that modernization is, and each of the counties' plan for that is where we're going. The other thing is that this bill doesn't make clear is we're changing the structure of public health, but we won't be changing it until we can move forward, so we need to make sure that we keep things in place that have to be in place in order to do the business while we're trying to create the future. The future is very important, because we really have seen with Ebola and measles and chickenpox and mumps that we just aren't ready to deal with the foundational elements. The other thing that's important to remember is that we will, in this bill, specify what the foundational elements of a governmental public health system is, but that will also make very clear that not all of it can be done by the government, that in order to deal with things that we have to deal with in the state over the next decade, there needs to be real public-private partnerships between of governmental public health and CCOs and schools and universities, as we've seen now, and hospitals and other kind of parts of the healthcare system, in order to allow the government to do what's required of the government's responsibility, but to work partnerships for much of the other elements of public health. We'll be working these two bills together. Probably the House bill will go first, but it'll have the amendments that will be in both bills. Your committee members will be working with our committee members and with the public health community to perfect this. It's got a ways to go, but I'm pretty confident we can get there. And what you'll hear is mostly, we support this bill, but, and that but's an important but that we listen to from all the folks.
And don't forget, in its current form.
That's right. But, and in its current form, two phrases.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Greenlick. I appreciate the work on this. I'm going to make an interesting suggestion. You and I have talked about this, that as we look at the future of public health at some point in time, although the connections need to be made, I think there's some value in considering it as a standalone agency. So,
I'm sorry, considering?
As a standalone agency. We've talked about this, so.
That's right.
Obviously, that would be down the road a ways. But
that was my plan in 2003.
I know,
when you
I know.
The chair of the health care committee.
Yeah. So I screwed up then, okay?
But the reason that I wanted to have a Senate bill, because it's really important for us to be, to know about this. Otherwise, that bill would have gone straight to Ways and Means.
Right.
And I think it's really important for the members here to know about that. But yes, we 2700 will be the one that'll be carried on through. Okay. No more questions? All right. We'll temporarily close the public hearing of Senate Bill 663. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 121. Senator Hansel.
Yeah, he's a
Thank you, Representative
Greenlick.
Thank you, Chair Moses Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Bill Hansel from District 29. I don't know, a year and a half ago, thereabouts, began to hear of an issue that was being raised in the city of Milton Freewater on a forced annexation. And as it began to unfold it began to be very clear to me that all was not right. We needed to do something. Met with the city officials, met with the county officials, met with health officials, and League of Oregon Cities. And pretty much from my perspective, there was an agreement that, hey, we've got something that we need to have fixed within the Oregon statute. So working together with all the different groups, we have come up with Senate Bill 121, which is sponsored for your consideration. Thank you for the hearing today. I'm going to allow, I would prefer to have the good folks from Milton Freewater who have traveled here, the mayor, the city councilman, and the city manager, along with Umatilla County Commissioner, to share with you the issues that are before us, and also the League of Oregon Cities representative, who has done a yeoman's work to craft the language to make sure that we don't inadvertently throw a baby out with the bathwater. So I think it's a good bill. We appreciate your support of it. One quick thing, you'll notice in the bill there's a couple of blanks, so we'll need to fill those in with dash amendments, which we're prepared to do. And we don't have them here right here, but League of Oregon Cities has the figures to put those in. So that's my what I wanted to share with you. And I'll stay around in case you have any questions, and let you hear from the folks in Milton Freewater.
Now, should we call the people first? Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
You want the others to come forward?
We'll
I think they're
them
part
up
of the team.
Yes, is this Linda Leanne Stedman?
Yes, it is.
Okay, you're on first, and then who else wants to? Why don't the other two? I don't have your names, but you come forward too. Is this Linda Hall?
Linda Hall.
And Lewis Key?
Lewis Key.
Okay. So, Leanne, are you going first?
Actually, Stephen Patton, he's a city councilor. He'll be going first.
Hi, my name is Steve Patton. I'm a city councilor for the city of Milton Freewater, and I am in support of this Senate Bill 121. The amended changes, I believe, will improve the cost effectiveness criteria for the city. The proposed annexation of the area would be a large cost to the city and its citizens, and providing the ability for the health authority to look at the cost effectiveness as part of their decision-making process would make this a better statute. I also think that amending the bill to allow for other alternatives other than just annexation would be a benefit, that there are other solutions to problems other than just full annexation. And by allowing authority to look at those other options would benefit both the residents of Milton Freewater as well as the county residents that might be annexed. And also, this bill would be a much better process to allow the city, the county residents that might be affected, more input in the process, and would just create a much better statute for all involved. And with that, I'd like to thank the Senate committee hearing for taking the time to consider this bill. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Linda, why don't we get your testimony, or the panel's testimony first, and then we'll ask for questions.
Certainly. I believe we might have had one more person waiting to testify. It's a citizen, Madam Chair, on the line.
Is there one more person on the line? Leanne?
Yes. Yeah. Service Stedman, and she's a citizen, and I'll have her go next.
Okay.
Chair Manez Anderson, my name is Service Stedman. I am from Milton Freewater, Oregon, and I own property in the affected subject health risk area. First of all, I would like to thank the Civic Committee for taking time to hear my testimony regarding Senate Bill 121. This bill amends the current statute by giving all parties other options to consider other than just annexation. There are a few key points addressed by this amendment that I would like to comment on. The consideration of cost effectiveness, in my opinion, as a criteria, is hugely important not only to the city and its citizens, but also to the citizens in the affected health risk area. This amendment would require a percentage of the residents in the affected territory to petition for annexation in a fair and equitable way. A petition was presented to city, county, and state department officials, signed by property owners in the affected area who were opposed to forced annexation. But the current statute did not allow the flexibility for any of those officials to act on our petition. This amendment allows for the consideration of other options besides just annexation of the entire affected area. The current law allows only one solution, annexation and extension of all services, if a public health risk is declared in the subject area. Property owners in the affected area have drilled wells and put in UV lights for the water issues, have put in sand filter systems and holding tanks to address the sewer problems. The point being, these property owners have addressed their own issues. This bill would implement some alternative avenues into the current statute that would allow for petitioners to withdraw their petition. In my opinion, this bill would be a much better law for all parties involved, offering more options and flexibility to cooperate in a most fair, equitable, and cost-effective manner. Thank you again for your time.
Great. Now it's your turn, Linda.
All right. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Monez Anderson and Senate Committee members. My name is Linda Hall. I'm the city manager with the city of Milton Freewater, Oregon, a small town of 7,000 in the northeastern corner of our great state. We came quite a distance today. It was a lovely drive, but we came with one purpose, to testify in support of Senate Bill 121. We want to thank Senator Hansel for taking the time and remembering our plight, and it's an odd one. I understand from the senator that, Madam Chair, you wondered why this bill might have been scheduled before your committee, because it appears to be a land use issue with annexation and not something to do with health, which is what you folks oversee. That actually, ironically, is at the crux of why we need a fix from Senate Bill 121 to the current statute. This statute comes into play when a public health risk is identified in a subject area. The current statute allows one of the ways that this is employed with a petition with as low amount of signatures from residents, not property owners, registered voters, residents, to start a process rolling after only 11 signatures that literally affects thousands in our case, the whole city of Milton Freewater and plus the majority of landowners in the subject area. There are no off-ramps with this current legislation and statute. There are no other alternatives. Annexation and extension of full city services, period. Not even or nothing, period. So even the petitioners, when they realized what they had set in motion, wanted to withdraw their petition. There's no access for that. There's no, our county commissioners tried to stop the train. There's no stopping this train. It's very frustrating, and it actually makes the city have to go against their own adopted processes and procedures, charter driven by annexation. It's a very frustrating and scary predicament that we find ourselves in, to which it puts everyone in a bad position. So we are very much hoping that you will honor Senate Bill 121 by agreeing to put it forward and save us all and give us the ability to actually work with our neighbors to solve a health problem instead of putting burdensome one-stop shopping on people that really didn't know what they were putting in place at the time. So thank you very much for your time. I understand this is the busiest session that anyone has heard of in quite some time, so we really, really, really appreciate the fact that you've scheduled this for a hearing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Lewis Key. I'm the mayor of Milton Freewater, have been for about 10 years, lived in the area my entire life, so I'm really familiar with the city. I very much appreciate the opportunity to express my opinion about the importance of Senate Bill 121. Without the directive of this new legislation, the current law could easily prove to be unfair to the majority of the citizens in the affected area. The current process could potentially add a huge cost to people in an area, forcing a project that they neither want nor can afford, as it does not provide for alternative solutions nor the cost-effective method to solve a problem. With the situation in Milton Freewater, we find a serious conflict of desires. We have a relatively small percentage of people looking for a fix to a problem, while on the other hand, the city has received a petition with a large number of signatures asking that they not be included in an annexation. To complicate this issue, the city has an ordinance directed at development that states that to be included inside the boundaries of the city, the development and the developer, not the city, must pay for the infrastructure extension to the newly annexed area. So the way the law is currently written, it goes totally against our ordinances. In addition, this new legislation addresses the possible situation that once the cost of the single mandated solution is realized by the people requesting services and is found out to be not cost-effective, it gives a method to look at alternative fixes rather than blindly rushing headlong into less than an ideal remedy. An example of alternative solutions, a small community to the west of Milton Freewater developed their own water control district with a new shared well with all the necessary safeguards to provide clean water to the people in this unincorporated area. By allowing for alternative plans with associated engineering studies to be considered, a solution that is truly the most desirable for an area can be developed. Another important feature of this bill is to address the consideration of cost of alternatives. The area in Milton Freewater under consideration is narrow, with a state highway running the length of it. This could cause additional engineering and costs just to provide for a mandate for this solution. Considering the separate infrastructure that would be needed for either side of the road, and because of the limited size and accessibility, it is highly questionable if the area could provide enough revenue to cover the cost of construction. Therefore, to work at all, there would need to be a huge grant of outside money to come in to solve a minor problem in our small area. In summary, this amendment allows for consideration of other options besides just annexation for an entire area when actually there is just a limited problem. It's never good government to offer only one solution when other options could be best for a specific problem. In conclusion, I want to offer a heartfelt thank you for you for hearing our testimony and considering our options. Thank you very much, Mayor Lewis Key.
And welcome. For those on the phone, do you still want to keep online?
Mute so they can't talk.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, I thank you very much for your time. I'm Warren Lyon.
Anderson, it's not necessary for us to stay on.
Okay, thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
I'm Council President Warren Lyon, City of Milton Freewater, Oregon. I think this amendment, Senate Bill 121, is very important not only to our city, but in my opinion, could at one time or another affect other cities. I think there are many more cost-effective ways to take care of this problem. One way is to address a specific problem instead of taking in the complete urban growth district. In my opinion, it is not good government to force one solution on the city when there are other options. Without this bill, private citizens could be adversely affected with higher taxes when many citizens have already taken care of the problem at their locations at their own expense. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel?
Thanks for making the drive.
Yes. Thank
Our
you
pleasure.
So much.
Thank you for hearing us. We appreciate
yes.
your
yeah,
attention
very
and
much.
Your consideration.
Then we have Larry Givens, Aaron Doyle, and Dave Leland. David, do you want to go next?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Umatilla County Commissioner Larry Givens. Thanks so much for allowing us to be here and testify today, not only for the county, but for all those that are here today. Again, thanks. Just a little bit of a brief history. You've heard some of the issues that have been brought up. As far as the county is involved in this, a petition of only 11 people was presented to the county forcing us to have to declare a health emergency and submit that to the Oregon Health Authority, which essentially started the process with the current very little used law that I think had only been used one time in the last 30 years. It put the county at a very huge disadvantage with having to force this issue, and it potentially forced the city of Milton Freewater into an issue that could have cost them or had the potential for costing them tens of millions of dollars. Infrastructure had been considered years ago to add sewer and water to this area, and it was found to be extremely expensive clear back in the 90s into the $10 to $11 million range. Today in those numbers, it would be a huge expense, one that the city of Milton Freewater probably could not afford to do, and something the county certainly couldn't step up and help them with. Umatilla County is in full support of this bill. This would allow, as you have had testimony, allow an opportunity for parties to be able to come up to an alternative solution that would help alleviate some of these issues and give them an avenue out of a forced annexation that could create millions and millions of dollars in debt to a city. Along with that, so many of the residents that signed a petition that the county was unable to respond to legally that opposed the annexation far outweighed the 11 residents who signed to have the annexation take place. This remedy was something they did not understand would happen or did not understand could happen when they signed the petition. It also puts businesses in that area at jeopardy because of the severe cost. So the remedy actually, if you want to use the term, the cure was worse than the disease. And it was a potential disaster for that community. With that being said, and keeping this testimony short, Umatilla County is totally in support of this Senate Bill 121. Again, thank you so much for hearing this testimony
thank
today.
Thank you for coming all the way over here. Any questions?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. This problem was presented to the League from both Senator Hansel and the City of Milton Freewater, and we wanted to find a finely refined fix to the issue, as opposed to taking the possibility of using the health and safety tools for annexing folks who need to come in when there is a septic or water problem. So we tried to think about the reasons why this arose to the level that it did in Milton Freewater and fix the legislation to address those particular instances, and I think in the end up with a better, more equitable solution that allows not only city budgets to be taken into consideration, but also the needs of the folks who are affected by the water and sewer problems. By changing it from a number of residents to a percentage of residents in an affected territory, that will require more equitable. So if there's 11 residents in the area that will be affected, you don't need 100%. But if there are thousands of residents that might be affected, 11 people can't move that destiny and bring on the bills that might come with extending infrastructure. One of the other things to consider is that when we do extend infrastructure out, oftentimes we use tools that require the folks who are receiving the benefit of the infrastructure to pay for the infrastructure, which in this case could be millions of dollars to a limited number of folks, and I don't know that anybody wants to pay $1 million for access to our sewer system individually. So by allowing for cost considerations, we can look at all of the alternatives and create the best solution. And finally, annexation is a tool that gets much talked about, but usually not in this committee, I imagine. And it's controversial almost at all times, except when done through a mechanism of consent. So when a city makes plans on how to do its land use planning, its infrastructure extension, its UGB, its buildable land supply, something like this could seriously change all of those considerations without much consideration of the effect that it will have on the overall land use structure and budget of the city. So I think that these changes that have been presented in Senate Bill 121 address all of those issues. I have talked to the chair and to Senator Hansel. I will be working with legislative counsel to draft an amendment to fill in those blanks. I have asked for the opinions of many of the other organizations that would be affected by this. I have yet to find anyone to give me any opposition or concern about this bill, so I will continue working on under those guidelines, but trying to do the best to create good, fair, balanced policy for all those concerned. I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the Health Committee.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Dave Leland. I'm manager of the drinking water services for the Public Health Division for the Oregon Health Authority. So I'm going to be really brief. I have some written testimony that I've submitted, but just wanted to mention sort of the context of where this law came from and sort of what our past and current efforts have been very briefly. Our position on the bill is neutral, and no surprise here. This is a pretty ancient statute. At least I'm running into fewer things that predate me, but this is one of them. Its title is Health Hazard Abatement, and its purpose was really to address some of these sort of developed areas, you know, kind of got to almost urban density in some cases outside of city limits. And then they're all on private wells, individual drinking water wells and individual septic tanks and drain fields. And they're all really close together. And when those systems go bad, you have the potential of people being exposed to sewage on the roadside ditches and contaminated and/or contaminated drinking water. But that said, there was quite a bit of activity using this tool in the 60s and the 70s and then in the 80s up through about 1990. And during that time, we actually declared 34 different areas around the state as presenting danger to public health under the statute, and the annexations were completed and services were provided, and so that really was what this tool was for. Since then, however, since 91, we've really only engaged in two of these. One was actually not under this statute, but under a companion statute about special districts at the request of Hood River County Health Department in the mid-2000s. And then currently we're involved with the Milton Freewater area at the request of Umatilla County. So I did actually give you a flow chart on this thing. So it was mentioned earlier that, wow, this is a pretty legalistic process, and that is true. So this little flow chart that I gave you actually has 20 steps in it, and it really the Oregon Health Authority can't initiate any of this. It has to be initiated by the petition, by the city, by the county. So we actually cannot initiate, but then we're sort of in charge of the process once it gets going. So there's a lot of steps to it, and in fact, in the Milton Freewater situation, we have not yet had number four, which is the public health hearing. So we've actually been putting that on hold for a while here because the city wants to do more thinking about alternate plans, and we're certainly willing to accommodate that. So I think with that, maybe I'll close, and really appreciate the opportunity to appear today. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, this is an issue that is sort of foreign to this committee. And is there any questions? See how easy we are? Now, maybe if it had gone to the Land Use Committee, it would be a little bit different. Well, we will wait for your amendment. And then now that we've actually had a hearing, we may be hearing from some other people too. But if there's no opposition that comes forward, we'll just wait for the amendment and then have a work session unless something drastic happens. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 121 and open a work session at SJM 4.
Madam Chair, I move SJM 4 to the Senate floor with a do adopt motion.
Senator Cruz moves SJM 4 to the floor with a do adopt motion. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Steiner Hayward, would you please carry this bill?
Yes, ma'am.
I close the work session in SJM 4 and open a work session on Senate Bill 146.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 146 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 146 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair. if I recall, we on this bill and maybe one other where we thought DCBS was affected, but yet they were not in the room. Would it be possible for the agency to come up and tell us what they think about
they
this?
They are in the room. Because we told them to be in the room.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my apologies. It was a little full in here, so we waited outside. And so just to be clear, are we already up at Senate Bill 146? Excellent. First of all, you know, we hadn't prepared any testimony on this, but we're happy to just kind of let you know what we've been looking at with respect to the small group expansion issue and the steps that we're taking on our agency bill, House Bill 2466, that deal with this. And I'm happy to also answer any specific questions that you have.
Wanted to know if this had red flags.
Sure. And I realize I'm not sure if I identified myself. I'm Laura Calley. I'm the insurance commissioner with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So as we looked at the bill, we didn't have any major red flags. We're looking to do something similar in House Bill 2466, where we would more closely align the definition of the small employer group with the ACA. So we don't have any major concerns at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Thank you. So how would this bill compare to House Bill 2466?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Shields. So right now we're in the process of working with legislative counsel to draft amendments to 2466 that would deal with this issue. But what we've requested is a little bit different from this, and it basically would align the definition of the small employer group precisely with the ACA as far as we can do without, you know, deferring to the federal law. We're still working out exactly how to structure the language, but it wouldn't kind of get into the details about, you know, the majority of employees residing in a state or headquarters. It actually just counts the number of employees for a given employer. And I don't know, Jeanette, if there's anything else to add to that.
I think that Jeanette Holman from the insurance division, for the record, I think that what we proposed was to just cite to the federal law, but to do that, as you all know, freezes everything in time as of the date of the federal of the enactment of ours. So we need, what we're working on is to try and come up with some language that will allow us to, if the federal law changes, to reflect those federal changes by rule.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Seeing no further discussion. Is there any clerk will call the roll?
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steinhaber?
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Knope, will you carry this bill?
Yes, ma'am.
And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 146 and open a work session on Senate Bill 228.
I need to go to Ways and Means, don't we? Okay. Madam Chair.
And, just a minute. Zena, would you bring us up to date? Remember, we had some questions on fees and wanting to know specifics on wanting to know some of the businesses that would be affected by this and their input.
Madam Chair, there has been a fiscal statement issued, but in terms OHA was having senators reach out to businesses specifically.
That's right, and we were given, they did send us a list to the various, I saw it. Yeah. And let us reach out if we wanted to.
Madam Chair, I thought I made it pretty clear to the Oregon Health Authority that I had concerns about this. Best that I can tell, they have not come to see me or have brought any of those resolutions to our...
All right, Health Authority, because I know I got an email with specifics to contact various agencies in my district, so maybe it was just overlooked.
Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Shields. Senator Shields, I'm sorry, I met with your staff.
And your name? Your name.
I'm Rosa Klein, for the record. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Public Health Division and the Radiation Protection Services in the Public Health Division. I met with Senator Knope and with Senator Shields' staff and gave them contact information for the businesses that are our licensees that would be impacted by these fees. And we felt at the Health Authority that because we regulate these entities, it wouldn't be appropriate for us to call them directly and encourage them to be supportive of this fee change because it could be seen as coercive.
Okay. And what did you get, Madam Chair, if I could
yes,
ask
please.
What did you give to my staff?
I gave several letters of support and then some contact information for about 50 or so businesses that we license.
And Madam Chair, follow up. Were those businesses in my district? Or?
We tried to get kind of a geographical variety and also a variety of different types of licensees. So we tried to find several from your district as well as several from each of the senator's districts.
Okay.
Thank you.
Are we ready?
We're ready. Are any other further discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm still opposed to the bill, just generally on the size of the increase of the fees. I think if it was less, I'd probably be supportive, but I can't be at these levels.
The information that I got was that they have not had an increase in 8 years, and this was not out of a realm of, with all of the changes that are happening. Do you want to give any more input on that? We are going to send this to Ways and Means also.
I would just note that the fees would actually cover the cost of services at the level that we currently provide. We're not increasing staff. This would just keep us with our head above water.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just to clarify, so that means that you're taking us from a net loss on regulating these to a net neutral?
Through 2019 with the increase of costs of services.
So, is Madam Chair, there's a fiscal on this then? Because if it's taking us to net neutral, there shouldn't be a fiscal or a revenue impact on this.
Madam Chair, it was a policy package in the governor's budget. It's another fund limitation of close to $600,000. So, I think just based on that, it should be under consideration in Ways
okay.
and Means.
And I talked with Ways and Means, the co-chair, and he did definitely say if you wanted to send it
That's
to
fine.
Them, it would be fine.
That's fine. I'll see it again in that committee.
Yes, exactly.
In that case, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 228 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 228 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Madam Co-Chair, I just got a text from my staff. Evidently, I appreciate you meeting with them. They met with my receptionist and gave them some documentation. I think I'd feel more comfortable waiting to vote on this, but since the motion's been made and assuming that that is your intention, I will be a no vote.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Knoll?
No.
Senator Shields?
Nope.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Walsh Anderson?
Aye. Motion carries, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 228 and open a work session on Senate Bill 505.
Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 505 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 505 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Knoll?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Mullins Anderson?
Aye. Motion carries, and I'll carry the bill. I'll close the work session of Senate Bill 505, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 231 and 609 together. I would like to make this very brief because we have a huge bill that we need to be talk about, which is our modernization of public health. So 231, who are the opponents? Need the list. And it looks like maybe we will combine these bills together somehow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's. So 609 and 221, 231 we'd like considered together if we could, Madam Chair. Do you want me to go or do you want other proponents of 609, excuse me?
Do you want to go down for 609?
It's fine if I do. There's also folks here from, I think we've got folks from the family physicians and we've got folks from the pediatricians.
Yeah, okay, so let's go ahead and please begin.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Nicole Merrithew, and I'm the director of the Oregon Health Authority's Patient-Centered Primary Care Home Program. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 231, an OHA bill. Overall, we are seeking to increase the speed and scope of primary care transformation and payment reform while also ensuring its sustainability. Through its health system transformation efforts, Oregon is counting on primary care providers to change care delivery, but payment incentives are not changing at the same pace to adequately support the adoption of new care models. There are numerous pilot projects occurring across the state, and we want to recognize that there are some very innovative things happening and some real success stories to go along with that. In the patient-centered primary care home program alone, we have nearly 550 participating practices and know that these clinics demonstrate better outcomes on select quality measures, as well as significantly lower specialty care utilization rates as their non-recognized counterparts. However, pilot project parameters and payer participation vary widely, which leaves some providers under-supported and others trying to juggle different initiatives and incentives across payers. Consistency and critical mass are lacking, and sustainability of these efforts is also a concern. In the fall of 2013, a majority of the payers in the state signed a voluntary agreement to use the OHA's patient-centered primary care home recognition as a common marker of primary care transformation and make variable payments to practices based on their level of recognition. While this agreement was a positive step towards sustaining health transformation work, providers are reporting that it has not resulted in meaningful payment changes for many. Uneven payer commitment means that some groups stand to reap the benefits of transformation without investing in that change. At the statewide level, we are also not investing sufficiently and equitably in technical assistance to help providers adopt these new models of care. These two things are both important. We need to give providers and clinics both the financial incentive to change their business practices and the knowledge and resources to know how to transform the model of care. Subsequent to the multi-payer agreement in December 2013, the Oregon Health Policy Board made a recommendation to the governor to expand and improve the primary preventive and chronic care infrastructure, specifically by increasing resources directed toward that infrastructure. OHA staff worked with national consultants, the Health Policy Board, and other stakeholders to develop the proposal you have before you today. Briefly, this legislation would establish a multi-payer primary care collaborative. All major payers, public, private, and self-insured, in Oregon would be required to participate to maximize the possibility for alignment across payers and to get the critical mass. The collaborative would be tasked with three things. First, it would identify a limited set of alternative payment methodologies for primary care that would be implemented broadly by all participating payers. A limited set of options means that providers are less likely to experience conflicting incentives. But payers could also experiment with other payment models outside of the collaborative. We know that we want to move away from an overwhelmingly fee-for-service payment system, but the evidence doesn't yet tell us which particular alternative payment methods work or are most effective in different cases. This initiative helps us understand what payment models most effectively support a robust primary care infrastructure in Oregon. Second, the collaborative would develop a formula to ensure that payers contribute equitably to technical assistance for practice transformation. The actual technical assistance would be delivered by a network of existing entities and would include retraining for existing health professionals. Last, clear benchmarks for initiative success would be developed. If the benchmarks are not met, the initiative would sunset. If they are met, it would transition to routine business practice. You will also hear testimony for Senate Bill 609 today, which, as currently written, is very aligned in intent with Senate Bill 231. In summary, we want to make sure that we are supporting the primary care system adequately, given the value and expectations that we have for it. Thank you for the opportunity to present this testimony today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. I hadn't realized, I'd only really expected to do 10 minutes on these two bills, and there's a whole lot of people signed up for 609, so let's just limit it to 1 to 2 minutes. Evan Salino, Liz Powers, and Dan Paulson.
Madam Chair, I'm not testifying on my own bill, and several of them are from pretty far away, so I don't know if they're really being the primary proponents of the bill. It's up to
Welcome.
You, of course, but... Dr. Powers is from Enterprise. Something of a drive.
Just for committee, if you have a bill and you're bringing it forward, you must let us know how much time is going to be allotted for your bills, because no one had told me that there was going to be this many people to testify on the bills. Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Hi. My name is Dr. Elizabeth Powers. I'm the president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, representing over 1,500 family physicians across the state. That's more than 80% of all the family docs in Oregon. Chair Mons Anderson and Co-Chair Cruz, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 609 and Senate Bill 231 today. I want to tell you a story about just one of the many patients that the medical system has failed, and how, despite that fact, this story has a happy ending. Now, I'm from rural Oregon, and I practice full-scope family medicine. I see patients in the clinic, in the hospital, in their home, in nursing homes, wherever they need me. A few years ago, I was working in the emergency department of our critical access hospital when I got a call from the nurse that they had a patient with chest pain. I rushed over to find one of my patients. Let's call him Greg. He looked awful, sweaty and pale. He gave me an apologetic grin. Hi, doc. He was having a STEMI, the worst kind of heart attack you can have, the one they call the widowmaker. Greg was only 56 years old at the time. I gave him some clotbuster medicine, and I arranged for his transport in a plane to the nearest cardiologist 330 miles away. That clotbuster medicine did the trick. It opened up the blocked artery to Greg's heart, and he came back to me in much the same state. Only I looked at Greg with a new set of eyes. I knew that I had given him top-notch care in preventing heart disease and for treating things like high blood pressure and cholesterol, yet this heart attack happened anyway. I practice in a Tier 3 patient-centered primary care home. Being a patient-centered primary care home means that our clinic is set up to provide Greg with the care he needs to improve his health above and beyond what has historically been deemed medical treatment. Our clinic has hired an additional 6 positions to help take care of patients outside of an office visit. When I asked my care team to become involved with Greg, I learned that Greg had trouble taking his medicines, that in some cases his medicines weren't covered by his insurance, and he was illiterate and ashamed to admit it. Hardest of all, his wife and his sole support system died nine months ago with metastatic cancer. Greg's needs were clearly more complicated than I could address in an office visit, and weren't amenable to treatment with medication. So instead of weekly office visits with me, Greg was connected to a care team who was able to get him the needed services. They got his medications approved, and they fill his medicine boxes once a week in our office. He was able to connect with our behavioral health coach about his prolonged grief, and with her help over time, he was able to get back in the community. Now he's lost some weight, and I see him biking everywhere, wearing the helmet our clinic gave him as a Christmas present. Greg is thriving. But the team of people who are helping to prevent Greg from having another heart attack are not recognized as having value in our current system. Their services are not paid for. In my practice, we get some per member per month payment from our CCO. These currently amount to 3% of our monthly revenue, while CCO patients are 27% of our practice. The cost of our care team, the 6 people we hired, is about 16% of our overhead. We need to get care management fees from all payers, and they need to be sufficient to support the value-added services of the care team. In Wallowa County, our transition to a patient-centered primary care home has decreased healthcare costs, increased quality, and improved patient access. Since 2008, in Wallowa County, hospital admissions have dropped 33%, and ER admissions have dropped 29%. Our diabetes control has improved from 68% to 84%, and my clinic used to be open 30 hours a week. Now it's open 64 hours a week. This has made a huge difference for the lives of those living in Wallowa County. At professional meetings and talking to Oregon Academy members, I run into countless others who echo my own uncertainty about being able to go further or even sustain the changes we've made so far without meaningful payment reform. Senate Bill 609 and Senate Bill 231 are looking to do just that, fund the work we're doing in our little frontier clinic to support our patients in their pursuit of optimal health, not only preventing Greg from having another heart attack, but giving him hope for his future. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Daniel Paulson, Vice President of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. I'd like to thank the committee for letting me testify today. I am the managing partner of Springfield Family Physicians, a Tier 3 patient-centered primary care home since October 2011. My story is about a middle-aged female who's been a patient in our clinic for many years. She had both schizophrenia and diabetes and was never able to manage her diabetes well because of the mental illness. She had a paranoia about needles, was not able to test her own blood sugars, let alone give herself insulin injections that she needed. She was also inconsistent about taking her oral medications for schizophrenia and was missing her mental health appointments. We connected her with an RN case manager in our clinic, as well as a social work case manager. Together, they saw that patient in her own home daily for about 3 weeks, testing her blood sugars, teaching her how to dose her insulin, creating a routine so that she could take her medicines consistently, taking her to the grocery store, teaching her how to prepare her meals, and taking her to her appointments with counseling. After that intense intervention, they were able to back off gradually, so that now the patient is independently testing her own blood sugars and giving herself her own insulin. She is eating a healthier diet and getting more exercise. Diabetes is controlled, and her schizophrenia is better managed. Yet none of these services that they provided is paid for by any of the insurance companies. We covered the cost through some pilot projects and some grants that we have, but most of that funding is coming from only a couple of our payers. All of the funding is time limited, and we expect it to expire in about 18 months. Yet we have another 100 to 200 or more patients that need the similar level of care. We could really use another two RNs who could do the same kind of work and another one or two social health care managers to meet these needs. Our clinic currently cares for over 13,000 patients. We've increased our staff by hiring the nurse care managers, more medical assistants, referral coordinators, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. We have co-located behavioral health in our clinic now with two therapists in the clinic every day of the week. Our office is open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. 5 days a week and on Saturdays to provide access to our patients. This has increased our overhead by about 25% since 2011. Almost entirely, this is going to the additional staff that we need for the PCPCH. Our clinic data suggests that our ER visits are down by 8 to 10%. We are doing more clinic visits and getting a better focus on preventive care, and we have a team of people who are working together to meet the patient's needs. Secure funding for the PCPCH will allow us to continue to employ these staff and continue to do this excellent work. Senate Bill 609 and 231 would be a big step forward toward that secure funding. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
All right. My name is Evan Salino. I am an immediate past president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, thank you for having me testify today in support of Senate Bill 609 and Senate Bill 231. In 2009, the Oregon legislature looked at the problems Oregon faced with respect to health care costs, quality, and outcomes, and evaluated the evidence about what would work to tackle these problems. And they established the patient-centered primary care home program, tasked with constructing a framework to enable this robust model of care to be provided to 75% of Oregonians, over 3 million people, by this year, 2015. At the time, that seemed pie in the sky. Even I didn't really think that was possible. But now, in 2015, we're approaching that goal. And over 70% of family physicians are practicing in a recognized patient-centered primary care home today in Oregon. I find this engagement astonishing. And I'm so proud of my primary care colleagues for stepping up to meet this challenge. This work is one of the biggest, most underreported success stories about health reform in Oregon. In addition to my clinical work, caring directly for patients, I contract with the patient-centered primary care home program to go out to clinics, visit recognized clinics, and understand how this model of care is actually implemented on the ground. I've had the honor of visiting a whole variety of different primary care practices in every part of the state. I have visited practices in every single one of your districts. At these clinics, I get to talk to the doctors, the nurses, the medical assistants, the managers, the organization and hospital CEOs, and even to patients about their experiences and trying to understand how the clinic provides high-quality patient-centered primary care. Similar to what you've heard from my colleagues here, I hear firsthand from folks across the state about the great work going on, but there are significant barriers to making that work successful and economically sustainable. Extensive national data shows that the benefits of these types of patient-centered care innovations, quality of care improves, patients are healthier and happier with their care, and cost savings are on the order of $1.50 for every dollar invested in this type of care. There are clearly positive results in Oregon as well, some of which you know about from the CCOs, some of it which you may be unaware of. There's a multi-payer pilot in Oregon with 66 clinics, and that's part of a national pilot that's going to end in 2016 as well. And that pilot has shown that clinics have hired nurses and other staff to provide better care coordination. And again, emergency room use is down, diabetes care is better. And even in the first year of the project, where costs are expected to rise, costs to payers have actually been stable. So the other thing I hear from basically every single clinic I visit is that the doctors, the staff, and the clinical leadership are basically at their breaking point. They're frustrated that they're trying to provide access for more patients while being pulled different directions by different payers, and they feel betrayed that this patient-centered primary care is not valued in our current system. They all tell me that they cannot sustain this model of care with the current way that primary care is paid for, which emphasizes quantity over quality. They even ask me, with pain looks on their faces, should I fire the nurses and social workers and behavioral health people that I just hired? Because there's no way to continue doing this. But I know it provides better patient care, so they feel very caught. Information from clinics in Oregon and from health economists nationally demonstrate basically what Dr. Paulson talked about, that implementing this care model requires time, technology, staff, and significant effort, and increases clinic overhead by approximately 25%. But except for the few scattered, small, time-limited pilot projects by payers, the vast majority of the time, there is still no way to get reimbursed for providing this high-quality, innovative, patient-centered care. Nearly 2 years ago, as you heard, the OHA brought together providers and payers, and we all signed an agreement to address this issue collaboratively. Despite their expressed support for this model of care, for various reasons, there has been no substantial progress since then. So the OAFP has stepped up to work collaboratively with other primary care and specialty physicians, nurses, and community organizations to put this legislation together. We've also worked with CCOs and insurers to modify the language of Senate Bill 609 based on their feedback. Senate Bill 609 will do two basic things. One is to provide a safe forum with a level playing field for continued collaborative discussion between providers, payers, and other stakeholders so that we can effectively align efforts, metrics, and financial incentives to encourage ongoing innovation in Oregon. This is basically what Senate Bill 231 does as well. This bill will also provide for action and accountability both on the clinic side and the payer side so that we don't just talk about this problem some more, but we actually take concrete action to solve it. Other states, Rhode Island, Colorado, Oklahoma, just to name a few, have recognized the same problem and formed multi-stakeholder groups where, for example, in Rhode Island, with aligned investment and outcome measures, data shows that payers are saving money and clinics are able to sustainably provide this high-quality care we know is good for patients. So by supporting Senate Bill 609 and Senate Bill 231, this committee and the Oregon legislature as a whole have an opportunity to enhance patient care and improve overall health in Oregon, ensure good, stable jobs in our communities, and continue our pioneering efforts to push forward with the exciting patient-centered primary care innovations across our great state. Thank you again for your time and attention to this critical issue. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you. What I'm going to do, I'm just going to have one more person testify, and then the opponents of the bill will carry the bill over and have the opponents, because we have to start. We have to get to 663. There are people from far away on that bill also. All right. Jay Rosenblum is the last proponent of this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Jay Rosenblum. I'm a full-time pediatrician. My clinic has a location in Northwest Portland, and there's a PowerPoint. You can refer to it. I'll keep my comments brief, but we have a location in Portland and one in Lake Oswego, but I'm also here as the medical director of the Children's Health Alliance and the Children's Health Foundation, which is a collaborative group of over 100 pediatricians, 22 different locations. In a classic sense, we are mostly competitors, but instead we all get together to work on how do we actually transform healthcare. For years, that's been a buzzword, is transformation of healthcare, and the Affordable Care Act and all kinds of things have addressed insurance reform, but what we're doing in the clinic is actually showing how it can be implemented. And as you heard from the previous folks from the family practice world, in primary care pediatrics, we face the same thing. The concept of a medical home has been around for decades, and when, you know, the old model was, you know, the doctors, you knew your patients, and actually there's a fair number of docs out there who still do this. You know, I know who my patients are, I know who the complicated patients are, I make sure that they get the care that they need. It turns out that is not only not cost-effective, it's not the highest level of care. We've been able to implement and look at what are the needs assessments of over 81,000 patients just from our 100 docs and say, who are the patients with the highest needs? And it doesn't necessarily meet the care and risk algorithms that the computers can build. You know, you can plug in the Johns Hopkins criteria, but that doesn't actually tell you who are the kids who are at highest risk, who are the ones that we can preemptively intervene and reduce their risk of poor health outcomes, and which it does improve their health care, it reduces the cost to the system, and it improves their experience of health and health care. So we have, and I'm happy to answer whatever questions you guys have, but it's we have implemented a number of solutions that that have involved new staff, as you heard. You know, but when 12 years ago we moved our office to a new location, and we need to move again because we have added 3 full-time integrated psychologists, a dietitian, we have 3 care managers. There is no way I can imagine how we would go back to practicing the way that we did 15 years ago. The care is so much better. Things don't slip through the cracks. 15 years ago, if I had a patient with who was failing to thrive and who had a seizure disorder and ADD, I would hand the mom a slip of paper with the phone numbers on it and tell her to call. And then I might not see them back for a year and say, oh, yeah, whatever happened with those things. That doesn't happen anymore. I have a care manager who calls them at least once a month and says, did you go to this doctor? Did you fill the medicine? We make sure that if the referral was submitted, was it completed? Did we get the notes back? And the list goes on and on. You know, I meet with the psychologist in person, and we say, you know, how is her anxiety? How is her ADD? Mom's limited medical literacy, all those things. So we are truly trying to transform healthcare, but we can't do it alone. You know, the multi-payer agreement that you heard about, you know, we all sat down and tried to work nicely together, but we have made an investment. We have hired the staff, and in the traditional fee-for-service model, that doesn't exist. There is no value. There is no that's just not a part of it. And so if we're going to transform healthcare and provide better care at a lower cost, we need help, and it needs to not just be us investing in the system at more and more and more personal and financial risk to ourselves alone. So thank you for letting me have a few moments, and
thank you for coming. And it is Family Physician Day today, so welcome all Family Physician Days. And I'm sorry that we just had too many bills to cover today, as we do every day, but thank you so much. I'm going to carry this bill on over to March 18th. It looks like will be the best day to have the opponents, sorry about that, opponents. With that, I will close the public hearing on 609 and 231 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 663, and let's start with Commissioner Bainey.
Do you have the list of who the opponents are? I'm just kind of curious on that last bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. I only have 45 minutes of prepared comments, so I hope that'll be
good.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
I am Tammy Bainey, Deschutes County Commissioner and Chair of the Task Force on the Future of Public Health Services. I'm here today to provide support for Senate Bill 663, which establishes the foundational public health capabilities and programs based upon the recommendations of the task force. I appreciate the collaboration and dedication that has brought us here today on this very important topic. Many of us in the room were invested very much in modernizing the public health system in Oregon and put in countless hours working together to bring this very important legislation forward. The task force was convened as a result of House Bill 2348 in 2013, and I'll try not to belabor too much of that, in order to provide recommendations to the legislature on the design of a public health system for the future. This task force was truly a collaborative and open process which lasted over 9 months. As customary in Oregon, our meetings were open to the public. However, knowing that success could only be achieved by including stakeholders and community partners, we purposefully created substantial opportunity for public input, often taking public comment multiple times throughout meetings. Membership to the task force included individuals from across the state, many of which are in the room today. We had thoughtful and sometimes spirited discussions about the appropriate direction that we were headed in. The task force recommended that foundational public health capabilities and programs be identified and funded so that appropriate levels of public health are accessible to everyone in Oregon. Senate Bill 663 makes that recommendation a reality. For example, the task force agreed that to keep all Oregon communities safe, we needed to assure that there were foundational public health programs in communicable disease control, environmental public health, prevention and health promotion, access to clinical preventative services, capabilities such as epidemiology, emergency preparedness, policy planning. Senate Bill 663 provides for the adoption of these foundational capabilities and programs. Public health is a critical component to the public safety system in our communities. Deschutes County is comprised of 78% public land. The communities of Sisters, Lapine, and Bend have developed into the urban wildland-urban interface. By creating defensible space, such as clearing brush, limbing trees, and using fire-resistant building materials, we reduce our chance of a catastrophic wildfire. These types of preventative actions are no different than the role that the public health foundational capabilities and programs play in protecting our communities from a disease outbreak. When we have a wildfire, we depend upon a coordinated firefighting program to protect citizens of Deschutes County and proven practices to prevent and mitigate fires. We expect reliable resources and foundational programs for public safety. We should expect the same from public health in Oregon. We need a robust and effective public health department just as much as you need a robust and effective sheriff's office. I believe that public health is not discretionary. It is a core service that government must provide in order to protect our communities. Yet Oregon currently ranks 46th in the nation in terms of per capita funding for public health at $13.37 per capita compared to the national average of $27.40. And I think that you can look at our overall health outcomes and say that there's a nexus. Unlike the system we have today, the framework the task force has presented outlines pathways for local public health to have the flexibility to operationalize the foundational capabilities and programs through a single county, a single county with shared services, or a multi-county jurisdictional structure. The framework also offers a better alignment with the CCOs in order to not duplicate efforts, rather to complement the efforts and the good work being done. Over the last 6 months, public health has needed to respond to new and emerging public health issues that threaten the lives of our most vulnerable citizens. Ebola, pertussis, measles, meningitis, if not managed effectively and proactively, public health threats have the potential to undermine many of the other priorities of our communities, including education and economic development. With the adoption of Senate Bill 663, we will move forward the conceptual framework for the foundational programs and capabilities of a modernized public health system for the state of Oregon. We still have much work to do to operationalize this, such as funding and pilot projects and what that might look like.
But I do look forward to working with all of you on that. Madam Chair, thank you so much for your leadership on this particular issue and for the time that you invested in the task force. And thank you for the opportunity to testify here with you today. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, publicly now, I want to thank you for being such a yeoman, wonderful leader in this process, because it's not an easy issue, and we have so many people that had different views of how this should turn out, and it seems like we've come, we're getting there to something that is really going to be good for Oregon. So, but thank you so much.
Madam Chair, thank you. It's an honor to serve.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lillian Shirley. I'm the director of the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to provide support for Senate Bill 663, which establishes the foundational public health capabilities and programs that are necessary to provide effective public health protections for everyone across the state. I have submitted written testimony, and I'll just kind of go through this in interest of time. I just want to say thank you to you, Chair Anderson, for your leadership, including serving on the task force and never missing a meeting, which provided these recommendations. The work of the task force resulted in a really collaborative product, as Commissioner Bainey has gone through and identified areas of the foundational capabilities. Some of the reasons the work was undertaken include the laws that frame Oregon's public health system today span more than 100 years, and many of these laws were adopted one by one over time. The reaction to disease outbreaks at a certain time and events that happened in the late 1800s and part of the 1900s. We have an opportunity to today, in the context of all of the work that we're doing around health transformation, to step back and craft all our laws in a thoughtful way that modernizes the way the public health system is structured and allows us to meet the health needs of everyone in Oregon. Traditionally, public health has played a role as a clinical safety net provider, having care for some of those most in need without insurance. But today, 95% of Oregonians are insured, and the healthcare delivery system is rewarded for efficiency, value, and health outcomes. While public health will still need to serve as a provider of last resort in some of our communities, in this new world where most are insured, it means that the public health system can now turn its attention to strategies and intervention that focus on making people healthier and preventing and detecting diseases before they wind up in the care system. Senate Bill 663 provides the framework for local health authorities and the Oregon Public Health Division to work collectively to determine the best way to serve everyone in Oregon. Local jurisdictions will have that flexibility, as Commissioner Bainey outlined, to operationalize the foundational capabilities through a system that works for them. And Senate Bill 663 aims to achieve sustainable and measurable improvements in population health through a collaborative, accountable, and transparent process between local and state public health. So over the next year, we'll work together as the public health system to define a roadmap to modernize Oregon's governmental system. First, together, we will identify a common understanding of the components of each foundational capability and each program listed. Then we'll assess the current capacity that we have around the state at the local level and the state level to identify how close we are meeting those foundational capabilities. Next, we'll identify metrics, both for activities and measurable health outcomes, to keep ourselves accountable to our citizens. And finally, because we do this work collaboratively, our work will identify and reflect the priorities and needs of communities across Oregon at the community level. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Well, I know that I've sent concerns about the bill to you, and hopefully we'll be able to come, as Representative Greenlink says, that this is a bill in progress.
Yes.
And we will see how we can address those issues. But thank you. Any questions? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Campbell, Pat Lubke, and Zeke Smith.
Madam Chair, can I apologize for Dr. Lukey? He had to leave.
Oh, okay. So then Carlos, is it Crespo? Crespo.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the CEO of the Eastern Oregon Coordinated Care Organization. I'm here today to speak in favor of the passage of Senate Bill 663, recognizing there are some amendments to come which can make it more closely aligned with the work group. Eastern Oregon CCO is huge in size and small in numbers of persons. We cover about 50,000 square miles. We have 50,000 members of the Oregon Health Plan scattered across those miles. We have about 200,000 people total, so about four people per square mile. Our challenge when we formed the CCO is how do we make it local enough to be relevant and big enough to be solvent? I think those are a lot the same challenges that public health faces. We recognize we spend a disproportionate amount of money on a small number of people. We recognize that many of the chronic diseases could be predicted if we had our act together sooner. And we recognize we're spending a very small amount of money on prevention. About 3% of the federal health care budget is spent on prevention. Countries with far better outcomes than us spend about 30% of their money. We need on prevention. We need to build on the backbone that we have established with public health. We need to recognize that regionalization happens best from the bottom up and not the top down, particularly in rural Oregon. And we need to have a standard expectation of what can be expected of any public health department in any county in the state of Oregon. But we also need to fund all of that. This needs to be done through a partnership between local government, state government, federal government, but also the CCOs. The public health can be a trusted agent of the CCOs in a prevention-based strategy that deals with some of the root causes of bad health outcomes, things like adverse trauma, adverse childhood events, trauma at the local level or at the person level, trauma at the community level, and poverty. We recognize that nurses that are visiting in the homes are essential to us determining future risks and future dangers to our children and also providing needed support to parents. We also recognize that many of the strategies that we've historically taken in things like prenatal care aren't accomplished by the phone, but actually have to be face-to-face and involve a level of trust between the public health nurse and the patient. But most important to us is the fact that public health is going to be torn if we don't do something. They're going to be trying to serve multiple masters in the community. We have early learning hubs, we have CCOs, and we have, and our CCO only represents about 25% of the population. We can't have two systems out there. We can't have a Medicaid system and then a system for everybody that's not on the Oregon Health Plan. In counties with small populations like ours, we need to move forward with community initiatives that'll best be emphasized with a population health approach and a preventative approach rather than a crisis response approach like we've had in the past. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carlos Crespo. I'm director of the School of Community Health at Portland State University. I'm also a member of the Oregon Health Policy Board and a past member of the Future of the Public Health Task Force. I support Senate Bill 663. Today's major health problems are obesity, smoking, substance abuse, violence, injuries. And these are not exactly medical problems. We try to solve them in the emergency room. We try to solve them with the office of the medical doctor. But these are community problems, and they need public health solutions. And this is a perfect opportunity for us to move and modernize Oregon public health government system. One of the recommendations of the task force is to implement these foundational capabilities, which are very important. The other recommendation is that we increase and improve significant funding to be able to identify what are these core public health priorities are. And I volunteer my colleagues in the academia to work closely with the locals and state departments to identify where these public health priorities are. But I think another very important component of this is to develop some accountability public health metrics. How do we know that we're making progress? How do we know that we are actually improving the health of the population? Population health is one of the most important aspects of our current healthcare transformation. And if we want to reduce the cost of healthcare, we need to keep the population healthy. Healthy people will use less healthcare. Healthy people is good for business also. So it is imperative that we think about how do we can keep our current population healthy. Lastly, I want to thank you for your participation in the task force, and I know this was an effort of many people from many different backgrounds, and they had a great commitment to make Oregon the healthiest state. Thank you.
And thank you for being there just about every meeting also.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much for the time to speak today. My name is Zeke Smith. I work at the United Way of the Columbia Willamette in the Portland metro area, and I also have the pleasure of serving as the chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board alongside my colleague, Dr. Crespo. And I am not the public health expert or health expert that other folks in the room are that you'll hear from or that are on this panel with me, but I am here to relay commitment from the Oregon Health Policy Board and support for the direction of Senate Bill 663. The Oregon Health Policy Board has set three priorities as we think about our work in the next year, and one of those is specifically about the integration of public health into our health transformation system. We've spent a lot of time, as you know, shaping, developing, and overseeing transformation of that healthcare system, and there's work to be done still. Pretty excited about the fact that we've successfully stood up CCOs as a state and that 95% of Oregonians are covered by insurance now, yet health care is a small part of the overall health of our state. And we believe it's time to make sure that health, public health is modernized and is equipped to serve as a strong foundation of a foundational health care system as we move forward. We're also excited about the fact that there the local flexibility that was expressed in both this bill and the House bill and the work of the task force. Public health is local health, and the strength of this bill is really about that local flexibility and the creative solutions that can be tailored to local communities. At the same time, we recognize that it's important to focus on our end goal, which is really about better health for the overall population. So as you heard from Dr. Crespo, the Oregon Health Policy Board is looking to support outcome measures and the expectation of what we can do in this state to support public health. The last thing I want to say is that the Health Policy Board will be monitoring what comes out of this work, and we'll be looking to support it as we move forward, as we support the Oregon Health Authority and healthcare transformation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you so much for coming. Appreciate it. Stacy Michelson, Charlie Fountain, and Morgan Cowling.
Madam Chairman, committee members, thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Charlie Fountain. I'm a public health nurse, health administrator for Benton County Health Department, and was privileged to be a member, like many others here, of the Future of Public Health Task Force. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials, CLO. CLO is supportive of the recommendations of the task force report and supportive of a bill that is amended to more closely reflect those recommendations. I'd like to tell you very briefly about what a local public health department does. An example is in 2012, when the MERS virus emerged in the Middle East, my population, because I know it well as a local public health authority, has a large Islamic population, a lot of travelers to and from the Middle East. We took that threat of MERS on a global basis very seriously, and because we already had excellent local relationships with Oregon State University, with the Islamic community, with Islamic students, we were able to get coordinated preventive information out very rapidly to those people who were going on the Hajj pilgrimage and to people who may have had family members and others traveling from the Middle East. Those are the sort of relationships that every local health department uses every day to monitor returnees from Ebola-stricken nations in Africa, to prevent the spread of measles, meningitis, and foodborne illnesses, and to be ready for the next emerging pathogen that might threaten Oregonians. Oregon's health reform has created opportunities for new collaborations, not only to enhance clinical care, but to help prevent illness from striking Oregonians in the first place, and that prevention is the true strength of public health. Intercommunity Health Network, the CCO in my region, is acutely aware that tobacco is a major medical cost driver and that its members have the second highest tobacco use rate of any CCO. Intercommunity Health Network is a co-grantee and fiscal agent for a coordinated region-wide tobacco prevention partnership with Benton, Lincoln, and Linn County Health Departments. This life-saving and cost-saving work is being paid for by tobacco master settlement agreement funds that were dedicated by the legislature to tobacco prevention. While IHN works with medical clinicians to encourage tobacco cessation, they're aware that the vast sums spent on nicotine marketing mean that cessation is an endlessly expensive treadmill, that tobacco prevention is necessary. Our regional project combines the clinical leverage of IHN CCO with the relationships that local health departments have to implement tobacco prevention programs in schools, to work with local landlords on cost-saving smoke-free rental policies, as well as other community strategies to reduce smoking initiation. I can confidently say that were my IHN colleagues here, they would also say that they do not have the mandate nor the skills to do the population prevention work that a local health department does, and that's why this partnership is so important. The foundational capabilities and programs model in the task force report and in this bill have the potential to provide better accountability, alignment, and coordination for our state and local health departments and improve this type of coordination. CLO very much appreciates the work of the legislature to move Oregon forward towards implementing a truly 21st century public health system and urges amendments to the current bill to more closely align it with the task force recommendations. I have written testimony and CLO has written testimony with detail about the type of amendments that we're encouraging, but very sort of Cliff Notes version is we'd like to see an enhanced public health advisory board to set metrics and have oversight responsibilities, a recognition that public health research and practice continue to innovate and to improve on past evidence-based practices and create new evidence, greater flexibility to form inter-county public health districts than is in the current bill, not abandoning current funding allocation systems until the full cost of modernization is known and the money to fully implement this model is available. Thank you for this opportunity. I urge the committee to listen as carefully to the voices of local public health experts as the task force did and give serious consideration to the amendments that CLO is recommending.
And thank you, Charlie, for being on that committee, too. Your input was extremely valuable, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I, too, will be brief to make sure others can testify. I'm Morgan Cowling, Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials. We are supportive of the bill with amendments. We believe that this bill will and the foundational capabilities and programs will move public health in the right direction with more accountability and align with other transformation efforts while giving local communities the flexibility they need. That said, the bill does still need some work to better align with the task force recommendations to reflect the important state-local relationship and ensure that local public health authorities aren't responsible for implementing this new model without significant investment in funding. I, too, submitted written testimony that went through the major areas of amendments that we would request, and we're looking forward to working with this committee and others on those amendments. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacey Michelson, Health and Human Services Policy Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'd like to say I asked Morgan and Charlie to go first so I could get up here and say ditto. I will also be keeping my comments fairly brief. But as many of you know, AOC was supportive of the task force in 2013. We followed the process very closely. We had already taken a position in support of the task force recommendations. And just earlier today, our group was finally able to take an official position on both this bill and the House bill. And followed closely, we are supportive with pending amendments. And we are generally following the lead of our public health directors. We are supporting all of Clo's suggested amendments, particularly around the issue of the shared accountability model. We feel that the bill as written diminishes the local public health voice in that shared relationship with the state. We'd like to see that strengthened. Support modifications to the conceptual framework that would allow for greater innovation and partnership at the local level. We also request that the communities be allowed to do a one-time plan. Our counties already do regular public health plans, and we see that as distinct from the plan around implementation of the foundational capabilities. And so we request that to avoid redundancy of work, that be separate and distinct from the community health improvement plans. We also align very well with Clo in sharing concerns over the funding and transition process to this new model of public health. As many of you know, Oregon is ranked among the lowest states nationally in terms of our state investment in public health. And so what that means is that our counties end up picking up the bill for a lot of our public health services and putting a great deal of their general fund into public health. So until we move to a model where we can guarantee that we are fully funding this baseline of services for our folks, we would like to see any changes to that funding system held off until we can guarantee that there is adequate funding available and hopefully a greater investment from the state around public health. And to that same point, I want to elevate this piece that, you know, our folks really value the relationship that we have with the state and the shared services model around public health. And I'm told that that is a unique model nationally, that our close relationship with the public health department is not terribly common. And I think one of the elements that really speaks to that is our work around the Rules Advisory Committee that took place when Douglas County said that they wanted to relinquish their public health authority. Commissioner Craig Pope of Polk County represented AOC on the RAC, and we really took that opportunity very seriously and used it as a time to say, you know, if a county is feeling so strapped that they're needing to give back their local public health authority, we want to do more than simply create a process for that to happen. We want to create a forum where counties and the state can engage and hopefully find a pathway forward to avoid that relinquishment, right? We want this to be an opportunity where we can partner and find a way to hopefully intervene and support the counties so that they can, you know, get back to a place where they're able to be the local public health authority. And I think our folks take that work very seriously. They would hate to see that all sort of pushed by the wayside. And so our current read of the bill is that under Section 115 in repealing ORS 431.375, that would remove sort of the current existing relationship that exists between counties and the state public health system. And we would hate to see that pulled out of current statute if we aren't yet ready to move to an entirely new model. So that's another piece that we would like to work on with amendments, either this committee or the House committee. I think that there is some agreement around that. And other than that, I just want to close by saying how much we appreciated this process and are excited to work with, you know, you, Chair Mona Sanderson and Representative Greenlick on putting together some amendments. I think we're really excited to see what this does for the status of public health in general, and particularly hopefully elevating the conversation of the role of public health in Oregon and the need for some improved investments in public health. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think it's important to know that we want changes in the system that's going to work better. We don't want to go back to what we have now because it's not working. And the culture here, in at least in this body, is not to support public health. And so when we're working on amendments, hopefully you will look at, we want a better system. We need to modernize. And maybe this is turf territory, but you've got to think outside of your out of the way things are right now. We have got we've got to not be as fragmented as we are now. So hopefully those amendments will reflect that, because I know there's turf and I know there's power and local control. All of this is involved, but we really do want to modernize public health. But the way I envision it is that the amendments are going to go through the House committee. I don't want the amendments to be sent to Xena and having, you know, staff create amendments for this one and that. We want the amendments to go through Mitch, and then we can just mirror those amendments for here so that we're not burdening legislative fiscal. But thank you so much. Okay, Tricia Tillman, Marnie Kyle, and Eva Repito? Repito?
Excuse me, Marnie had to leave.
Okay, Marnie had to leave. And then Gary Oxman.
Just the two of us.
Good.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Tricia Tillman, and I'm the Director of Public Health for the Multnomah County Health Department. And I'm really happy to have the opportunity to provide testimony on Senate Bill 663, although our written testimony had a little typo, so we'll correct that. First, I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Greenlick for your leadership efforts on this issue. This bill is an extension of the work of the Public Health Task Force, and we are grateful for your leadership in prioritizing the work of public health modernization. I'm here to express my support for the framework that's presented in Senate Bill 663 and ask that you consider amendments that create a strong system of shared governance. Multnomah County is committed to realizing a modernized system where everyone, regardless of where they might live, has access to effective and robust public health services. The assessment and planning framework of this legislation proposes creates an opportunity to transform our work to meet increasing needs for fundamental public health services. In order for this transformation to be equitable and effective, collaboration across the entire system is imperative. Multnomah County and the Oregon Public Health Division have a strong history of collaboration, and the proposed legislation is an exciting opportunity to continue to strengthen and grow that cooperation and coordination for greater public health impact and to meet the documented needs within our communities. The Task Force on the Future of Public Health recognized the importance of a strong system of shared governance in ensuring full implementation of the foundational capabilities and programs. We encourage a collaborative approach to further aligning the legislation with the vision of the task force by making clear that state and local public health officials are equal partners in informing both the policy direction and ultimately the investment strategy for a modernized system. We support amendments that create in statute a venue where local and state public health officials can make these policy and fiscal decisions collaboratively. We look forward to continuing this work in true partnership with the Public Health Division and local public health departments across the state to promote health where we live, learn, work, and play. Thank you for the opportunity to share, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Tricia, and welcome to your new position.
Thank you.
I'll miss you in the old position, but...
Same goals.
Yeah.
Less commute.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Gary Oxman. I'm a public health physician and worked for about 25 years in public health, served as a health officer for 25 years, all on a local basis, 19 for Multnomah County, and then as a regional health officer for Clackamas and Washington County as well for the last several years of my career. So I want to start by thanking you, Senator Mona Sanderson, for your involvement in the task force, and your leadership was absolutely critical. I was a member of that task force, and it's very nice to see our work coming to fruition with the bill here. I'm here to speak in favor of the bill. I think overall it's a really good bill. There's a little fine-tuning, as folks have acknowledged, but that shouldn't keep us from moving forward on this. I really just want to address a couple issues related to the findings of the task force, First, the task force found that we really need to reorient our public health system around health outcomes. We really need to make that transition from providing services and doing things to really looking at what outcomes are we producing? Are we really improving the health of the people? And this is really this is parallel to what's going on with the CCO model and the healthcare delivery transformation. On a policy level, what this means is really clear state and local goals and priorities. What problems should we be working on? What should we be doing about them? What can we expect to achieve? On an operational level, it really means well-defined metrics. What you measure really drives what you do. So we, and in public health, this is particularly tricky because so many public health conditions and so much about our state of health depends on lots of different factors. So choosing a metric becomes really important. But on all levels, I think we really need to emphasize that outcomes promote accountability. As policy leaders in the state and as funders for various efforts, you really have the right to expect that the public health system should articulate for you what's the opportunity to improve health or what problem are we dealing with. What can we do to address the situation, along with the evidence that shows that, gee, we really can do something about this, how we'll measure our progress, and what the cost will be. That's the kind of information that I think you really need for thoughtful investment in public health. Everybody needs for thoughtful investment, whether it's the legislature, local jurisdiction, or community partner. And I believe that that Senate Bill 663 will really improve the outcomes orientation of our system, largely through the implementation of the foundational capabilities, specifically epidemiology and assessment, planning and policy and leadership and health equity. Those are particularly relevant to achieving outcomes. The other finding that I want to touch on for just a minute is that the task force found that there's really an opportunity and a necessity to change our structure in public health, that our structure, we've been working under the same structure for more than 40 years, or about 40 years. A lot has changed since that happened back in the 70s. We really need to update our system. And one issue that we found in the task force is that the current structure really doesn't promote a well-integrated approach by state and local governmental public health, and it doesn't optimize the contributions of our community partners either. And this occurs despite the fact that we've got wonderful, intelligent, well-trained, committed public health professionals at both state and local public health and community organizations. It also occurs despite the fact of having many examples of how to do it just right. And I think the structural problem is that there are just too few incentives in our structure to thoughtfully integrate the best in state and local practice. The other issue with the structure is that there's too much flexibility. I'm a huge proponent of local public health, and I believe we've got too much of a good thing in Oregon. We just have too much flexibility jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And so we really need to do more to get the system integrated so that we're producing consistent results for our communities, recognizing that different communities have different needs and different desires. So I think that, again, Senate Bill 663 really addresses that through creating a statewide community health assessment, statewide health improvement plan, and then also authorizes local health improvement plans and local health assessments to really put together a state and local voice. And finally, the bill creates a structure and potential incentives for counties to explore and implement regional approaches and to do so on a voluntary basis, so really building regionalization from the ground up rather than carving the state out into several regions. So it promotes regionalization, but it doesn't push it down on the communities. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Oxman, for serving on that task force.
My pleasure.
Also, and I think that you summed it up really well, because I am concerned that the amendments are going to come forward and get us back to the same way that we were before, which we can't. We do need to have a better integrated system, just like you said. We need to focus on those foundational capabilities, and we need to have some consistency. And it's really important for that local health improvement plan, because like you said, each county is different. And like Douglas County, that gave theirs up, if we had a system where we could look at maybe sharing services amongst some counties, et cetera, we need to be looking at that. So promoting regionalization, if it works, I think is extremely important. So I am excited. I think that we have not funded. We have to change the culture. If we stay the same, it's not going to change the culture here. And so I want this to succeed, but I don't want to go back to what – I don't want the amendments to go back to what it is now. And I know – and hopefully that isn't what's going to happen. But is there any – Yeah.
Just to comment, in the case of Douglas County, there are
Eva.
They may not be the only county that ends up going there, and there are some legal ramifications in that haven't really been addressed. So it is, there is some critical issues here.
It's almost five. Thank you, everyone, for coming. With that, I'll close the public hearing on 6-6-3, and thank you, committee. I'm sorry that we had to have 609. Couldn't finish that one, but we needed to make sure that we heard everyone on this bill, too. With that, we're adjourned.